We definitely have a quorum tonight.
Yeah.
So, back into the realm of the self and the body and the mind and this whole exploration. Bring up another, at the beginning, another old sutra from the Buddha, from Pali Canon, about the self. And I think this one's particularly, it's very short, it's just like a paragraph or so, and it really emphasizes this middle way view of the self, where it's not that there's no self at all, and it's not that there's a fixed, solid, independent self. Usually the Buddha, you know, is known for teaching anatman, you know, no separate self or not self. Various aspects of body and mind are not self. But here's an unusual sutra that brings up the other side too. The wanderer Vajragotha went to the Blessed One and on arrival exchanged courteous greetings with him and then sat on one side. And as he was sitting there, he asked the Blessed One, "Now, Venerable Gotama, is there a self?" Goes right to the point. Is there a self? And the Blessed One was silent. Instead of saying, "No, of course not." He was silent. And then he asked, "Well, then is there no self?" A second time, the Blessed One was silent. Then Vajragotha, the wanderer, got up from his seat and left. It sounds a lot like some of these Zen stories, right? It's a very early Zen story of the Buddha. And then not long after Vajragotha, the wanderer, had wandered off, Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Why, Lord, did the Blessed One not answer when asked a question by Vajragotha?" The Buddha says, "Ananda, if I, being asked by Vajragotha if there is a self, were to answer that there is a self, that would be conforming with those priests and contemplatives who are exponents of eternalism, the view that there is an eternal, unchanging self." Right? You follow that part? So if there is a self, then that would sound like one of the philosophical views that was going around at that time, that yes, there is a permanent, eternal, abiding self. If I, being asked by Vajragotha if there is no self, were to answer that there is no self, that would be conforming with those priests and contemplatives who are exponents of annihilationism, the view that, this is just added in by the translator in parentheses, the view that death is the annihilation of consciousness. So it's like the other extreme. Is this tonight's discussion? Well, you know.
I was an exponent of, we just die.
We allow, you know, a nice annihilationism in this room.
Yeah, me and Brian, man, we were the annihilationists.
You know,
like, so yeah, that's a you know, that's in the you know, added in interpretation here, but I think that is in accord with, we also talked about this, you know, rebirth a little bit last week. It was one of those common divergent topics that we get into because it's so interesting and strange, but this middle way accords with this kind of a continuation of a continuity that's not us, not a self, not an actual entity that continues on, but also not the other extreme that there's, you know, it's the end. Those are the two extremes in terms of the middle way, that things substantially abide, and the other extreme is that they don't, there's nothing exists at all. So, you know, say after death, but you could even say, you know, as I say, that's the interpreter, is the translator's interpretation. You could even say right now, in this life, one extreme would be there really is this independently existing core self, and the other extreme is that there's, you know, no self at all, to the extent that we shouldn't even say the word I, because that's already like off track. So remember these types of self on this handout, that there is this conventionally appearing mere I, which is like the middle way. It's not a reified self, and it's not a completely non-existent nothingness. Buddha just goes on a little bit longer and saying, if I, being asked by Vachagota, if there is a self, were to answer that there is a self, would that be in keeping with the arising of knowledge that all phenomena are not self? So he's saying, you know, you've heard this teaching before, that all phenomena, all five skandhas are not self. And would that be in keeping with that? No, Lord, Ananda says. And so that's maybe the obvious answer. But then he says, if I, being asked by Vachagota, if there is a self, were to answer that there is no self, what's the problem here? He says, the bewildered Vachagota would become even more bewildered. Saying, for example, does the self I used to have now not exist? Because, you know, there seems to have been a self up to that point. Well, does it now not exist? Or after death, is there nothing at all? It's a little abstract there, but I think the interesting point is that he says, if I were to say there was no self, period, then most people would just become bewildered and confused, and like we often do, right? But maybe before this class started, well, this thing of no self, but there is a self, we say, right? So that's why I have to really clarify what it means and what these different types are. That's from the Samyutta Nikaya, section 44. Before we step into this next section, is it clear, basically, what this self is that we're actually going to start investigating and, refuting, logically refuting?
Is it clear?
Yeah.
Which of the ones? I have that.
Yeah, do you remember this now? This is, I don't know if you think about this between classes at all, but yeah, number three, right.
The first type of self, the dependent, interrelating, inconceivable. Second, the imputed self.
Yeah, so I think two and three on this list are the key.
Third is that presumption of this inherently existing self.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what we're going to repeat. Because the first one we don't have to repeat, because it does exist conventionally.
Yeah, it does, exactly.
But the other two, we make something of it.
Yeah, the...
We try to make something.
The conceptually imputed... Does anyone need one of these handouts for today? I think we'll just use this one for now.
Right. The conceptually imputed, and then this inherently existing...
So the conceptually imputed, isn't that interesting? That's okay, actually. That's just it's just a mental thing that it's okay to do if it's merely a conceptual imputation, right? Mm. So.
So three is really the main.
Three is the thing, right? So that's the. That's the illusion that the conceptually imputed self exists by way of its own character, from its own side. So another way to talk about this that I just in studying this heard is like a new kind of like slant is that in a way kind of like this list, but it's like these three layers of like building a self, and the basis to begin building is the body and mind, the basic body-mind experience. We're called the five skandhas. And then, based on the five skandhas, or we could say based on or dependent on body, mind, five skandhas, we come up with this kind of mental image of me. That's the mere I, the conventionally existing mere I that depends on the body and mind. So it uses that as its material to impute. So can you follow like the difference between those two?
So there's just the body, the existent body, mind, skandhas, they're doing their thing.
Yeah, just arising and ceasing each moment.
And then the next layer is the mind that makes something of that.
Yeah, that makes something of that. And to speak accurately, because it's quite subtle stuff we're talking about, it's an imputation dependent on the body and mind. It's the thought of me that's not exact. The nice thing about saying dependent on is it's like it's not exactly the thought of me as the five skandhas. That would be a little different. Can you see how it's a little different? Then often that's how when we first hear these teachings of no self, we hear. This is how I often first heard it. Was like there's no independent self. There's just five skandhas. And who am I really? I am just five skandhas, the body and mind. And that's kind of a coarse, it's still somewhat, you know, undoing the fixed, solid me, but it's a little more coarse view. So it's not exactly that I am the five skandhas, but I, the conventional I, am just a mental, conceptual imputation dependent on the five skandhas. See, others are slightly different. And that's worth, like, you could even, if you can remember that, check that out when you're really quiet in meditation and see if you can actually tell the experiential difference between those two. Because it sounds like a lot of words, but there's something actually, a sense that's a little different there. In fact, where I read this teacher was saying that just to view the self, the conventional self as merely the five skandhas will never actually free us from samsara. Mm-hmm. That's a radical thing because it's somewhat helpful. To kind of understand that the body-mind experience, arising, ceasing body-mind experience, is the so-called self. The conventional self, or to say there's no independent self because actually the self is just the body-mind experience. That view, even though it sounds pretty good at first, this person said, it's not enough to actually free us from this illusory cycle of entrapment. We need a more subtle view that's the mere I, the conventional self, it has to do with mental projection, actually. That's why it doesn't change our experience too much. It changes a little bit, I think, to say like, oh yeah, it's just this body-mind, but to say that actually we create this view of ourselves, independence on the body and mind, but it's actually a mental image. It's a conceptual imputation. Which is, obviously, a conceptual imputation is a little different than body and mind.
So it's basically saying that the liberation comes from, like, being able to see your tricks.
Yeah.
Understanding that, you know, I do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, understanding how we do it.
Which is different than just the skandhas flowing along.
Yeah.
It's like actually being able to pull the plug.
Yeah, understanding.
To recognize that there's this tendency to.
Yeah. Well, now, and then there's a third layer now. So these are the first. So it's really the third is that we're really catching this trick, which is, so remember the first one is just the self, the body and mind, five skandhas is the first layer. The second layer is this conceptual imputation dependent on that, that kind of like, almost you could imagine it as kind of like slightly removed from body and mind, looking back on it. It's like kind of like a witness kind of looking at the body and mind slightly from outside itself. Now, I'm just talking now, so it's maybe that's not exactly our experience, but that's just an image that we might be able to see how it's a little bit separated from body and mind. And experientially, I think that for an example of how that shows up in experience is when we say, my body and mind. Right? My body and mind, it's like we feel like there's a me that's kind of like, you know, possesses the body and mind. That's a little bit removed from it. We could say what that actually is, it's just this idea that we're miraculously able to do, like, very easily, you know, at a very young age, the sense of myself that then can, like, seem like it's some kind of, you know, container or controller or viewer of body and mind experience. And then the third layer would be, like, basically believing that that mere conceptual imputation is a lot more than that, believing that it is actually an independent, you know, abiding, core, unchanging self that exists, not dependent on mental imputation, but exists truly, independently, in and of itself.
Can I paraphrase?
Yeah, please.
And I'm not sure about this paraphrasing, but I'm kind of thinking that the innate deeply rooted illusion that does not exist at all is actually, okay, number three, maybe the concept of that, the conceptualization of that, we don't recognize as a concept. We recognize it as truth.
Yeah, more than a concept.
It's the seeing it as being a truth that is the inherently existence.
Yes.
That doesn't exist. But it's realizing it's a concept, the concept itself, that studying this, if we can come to this conclusion that we realize that it really is only a concept, that's a major step. But the concept is what exists conventionally. The concept of it inherently itself. That's what really exists, because concepts, ideas, I just have a reality, a mental reality.
Yeah.
Even about things that don't exist, but the concept itself can be real, because it starts worse.
Real, and I mean, it's real can be a loaded term in Buddhism. So.
I don't mean phenomenally, but phenomenon that exists in the physical, the phenomenon.
Conventionally existent.
Yeah.
Sometimes we use real to mean like inherently or truly. It does definitely conventionally exist. But it ultimately.
I mean, skandhas include concepts, mental logic.
Yeah, concepts function in the world. That's our whole experience of life, according to the story.
Bad concepts that aren't physically true all the time by accident.
Yeah.
So it
occurs to me that, you know, how we had this, you know, Yogacara mind-only class, and I think that I'm happy that we had that before this, because for those who were there, this is very similar to that view. It's like that the mind is basically constructing a version of things that's like not actually in the things.
Right.
And it's not that there's nothing, but it's just like the way we experience everything is through this filter of our conceptuality.
So this is kind of like the Yogacara,
very similar.
The inherently existent self itself is one of those things that we're inventing.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. In the mind only system, the imputational character of all things. Remember that one? That's like the reified. You know that particular term, the imputational character of things, is through imputation the belief that things exist in and of themselves.
I wonder if we can again try to paraphrase it. Now I'm not going to try, but I like examples.
Mm-hmm.
So, and part of the homework was say think of yourself. The one that I picked up on was being slandered or something like that. So so you said kind of just live with that. Find that little spot of self, Look, I'm pointing to my head.
Probably up there.
We often associate it with the head, yeah.
So, I can see that self, and I can see beyond that self also. So, if you could go those three layers again, with maybe just like an exercise, like
So say like we're falsely accused or truly accused or, and in fact, as I often like to say, when people say an example, well, every moment of our life is always an example. Like if this is happening as we speak, right? But the dramatic ones are good to bring, to get a feel for it. So like when we have that charge of like we're falsely accused and we feel that welling up of like me, like not me or not me. How can you do this to me? How could this happen to me? With the underlined me. There's just the body-mind experience. There is something happening to the body-mind experience when someone accuses us. It's in a way they're accusing our skandhas, you could say. They might be accusing our body, like, how could you have, stepped on my favorite cup, or something like that. Like, then they're accusing the body, the form, skanda. Or they might say, how could you have forgotten to meet me? Then they're accusing the karmic formation, skanda. And that's what that, last week, I wrote that sutra where the Buddha said, if people attack and abuse me, I don't get upset because I realize they're attacking and abusing the skandhas. But we don't think that when we attack someone. So this applies not only to ourselves, but when we feel blaming towards others, to see them also as not exactly a self in the way we think they are, but like which of their skandhas do we want to blame? That might help us, it might diffuse the blame, right?
That's very interesting. You know? Or by the same token, which of my skandhas feels blame?
Yeah, so that's in this example.
Which of karmic formation?
It's usually that one, I think, yeah.
But is it also just like, just the feeling of like your gut tightening? I mean, is
I don't think we have to identify. It's usually the combination because we build the sense of self on generally the combination of all five. Sometimes we single out one skanda, like if we're in intense physical pain in one area, like last time we were talking about the toe or something, then we might really feel like I am the toe, like all our attention is going there, and like this is me that's like really being threatened here. But generally, it's like the whole set of body mind, and then this happens instantly, but then we. It's already happening that we have this view of me, that the mere I that's depending on the body and mind. So that one, in a way feels threatened too because they're kind of attacking the skandhas, but this one that's kind of like, you could say that's surrounding the skandhas, that's the possessor of the skandhas, it's like, how dare you accuse one of my skandhas, this little one out here, right? It's not exactly how an experience what it's like, but as a story, it's something like this, There's this sense of me that's like surrounding the body-mind experience, and that one's saying, you're attacking, my employees here. My body and mind employees. I'm the boss, and they're my employees. And then, you know, again, this is like not really in sequential order. It's because it's all at the same time, really. But then that one also feels like it's not just like my employees. This would be the third layer now. It's not just body mind experience. It's like there really is this core me. And this is the one we're really trying to identify, this sense, you know, ideally before we start undoing it, so it really we feel the impact of it. But I think it's hard to identify this sense, that to tell the difference between say 2 and 3 on this list, right? Between just mere conceptual imputation of the self and believing that that truly exists. I think the reason why it's so hard to tell the difference between them is that for an ordinary being, they're completely interfused together. They're actually, we never pull them apart. That's what we're doing in this class. Maybe for the first time, we're starting to like see how there's actually, they're not exactly the same. So that's the thing, I think, but that's a proof, or I'd say a kind of evidence for the fact that we living beings generally feel like it's more than just the body and mind, because we feel like this true me feels falsely accused. We don't just feel like it was the fourth skandha being accused, or it was the body being accused. We feel like the whole package of me-ness, and we don't even think like, we usually don't even feel like, oh, this body and mind package got accused. We feel like there's something more than that, don't we? We feel like it has to do very closely with our body-mind experience, but we feel like there's something more. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to show this experience I was having as we were going through all this. I'm nodding my head. But how come, you know, I'm sitting here and myself is not at all threatened? Like, myself is threatened all day long, you know? Why, when I'm sitting here, when you're telling me that there's not, so, I mean, really, why do I feel so safe here? And I'm wondering, like, anybody else is feeling that way too, like, it's like I'm on this island and it's just going by me. Oh, that's interesting. Shouldn't I be, like, really nervous?
Does anyone have a CD?
We all get nervous.
I mean, has that happened to you? Did you really look into this? Does it make you uncomfortable as you start getting closer to that, or more so?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, because actually there's a way in which the more we're meditating on this stuff, the whole point, of course, is that we feel more at ease, and also in a way, it may be the further we go into this, then maybe the harder it is to identify the really fixed, reified me, because we're already seeing how, come on now, it's not really going to hold up. That's why there's all these examples of, like, if it's hard to find, imagine these really difficult situations, or wait till you're in one, which is, you know, which will happen eventually when you least expect it. And then we feel like, in a way I was thinking about it last time, and when the CD shattered, because people did, there was this feeling, I think, that I even had too, like some kind of threatening thing, and there's like, our bodies are being threatened, and our minds, and like, you know, what's going to happen here? And so there it is, a perfect opportunity and we could say, but what if it's really threatening? Well, but life is, in a way, really threatening. So it's like, those are the times, ironically, when we least remember to do this kind of meditation. So when it's actually in real life, you say like all day long, there's times when this comes up. Those are great times to look. And then after today, maybe we'll get into this investigation enough that you can remember the kind of shorthand version of the investigation. And it kind of like diffuse it, actually, when it's happening. But for right now... Even if you can't, even if it's not as strong, and also it doesn't have to be a negative emotion. It could be even like, just, I feel really content now. It's harder, I think, to do that, but it may be just like, because again, it's happening right now, right? There's a sense that, doesn't it feel, I mean, I can feel this sense of like, that there's somebody here in addition to just like, you know, words coming out of just empty space. Almost you can even have it at the same time. Maybe it even, I can kind of like shift it to like, let's see how it, feel how there's just words coming out of empty space and like I can't even tell where they're coming from. And yet at the same time I can shift this perspective and feel like, well, there's some like identity here. Yeah, I'm not really focused on it while I'm talking, but I kind of have a sense of it too. There's a located me-ness.
Yeah, but when we talk about sensing something, understanding it, or knowing it, I keep wanting to call it intuition, and I wonder, is there such a thing in this process as intuition that we can trust? It's not clouded by or you know preconceived ideas. There's something that really we can trust, that sense of like, oh yeah, you know. It's not really a mental process. Well, maybe it is. I guess that's my question. Is it really something beyond that?
Well, now we're talking about the sense of this illusory independent self. We're just right at this moment, you know, that we're looking for the sense of the false self that we do trust, but we falsely trust. So, and on that level, I think we can, to locate that false sense, which is what we're doing at this point, we're locating the kind of the culprit. I think we can find an intuitive sense of that one. Now, you might be also asking about, what about like the freed, the kind of realization of no independent self. Can we have an intuition of that? Is that part of?
Well, yeah, because I know everybody here is kind of have the idea that it's safe to negate things eventually. We have a sense that things aren't solid, that things aren't in a certain way. And I'm wondering, is that based on the experience we've had, something we can really lean on? And it's like going back from the process in a way of like, okay, we know this is where we're going, but why do we know?
Yeah, I think in that sense, there also is an intuition. Like sometimes we can talk about it, like the two sides of like, there's, I think last week I mentioned, there's like an innate, inborn view of like the independent self that's like innate ignorance or delusion. So that's like, you know, not exactly like original sin in Christianity, but like it's getting there, you know. You know, it's like original delusion, right? And then at the same time, in Mahayana Buddhism, there's original Buddha nature that's like, and Buddha nature we could speak of in this case as something like the inherent, innate trust that actually everything is empty of independent existence. And I think, you know, this is a particularly Mahayana Buddhist thing, is that it's a very positive thing. You know, early Buddhism is just talking about there's this delusion and how are we ever going to get over this ignorance? And in the Mahayana, it's like, well, this is what's going to help us, is we also have this Buddha nature that's like our, who we truly are in a way. Like number 5 on this list of types of self, the true self. Right? I kind of made this up, but this ultimate truth beyond existence and non-existence. And I think we do have some intuition of that. And especially, I feel like maybe everybody has some intuition, but particularly people who like come to a class like this, I think it's because we have some intuition that actually that we actually, our normal experience of the world is kind of clouded over by a by a layer of falseness. Now, even Chandrakirti, one of the great commentators on Nagarjuna, has a famous verse that's at the beginning of his Madhyamaka Avatara, that's kind of commenting on Nagarjuna's work. He says, who are the people who are appropriate vessels for hearing these teachings about emptiness and Nagarjuna? You know, ideally, the ones who are really, really ready to hear are the ones who, even just hearing the word emptiness or hearing about emptiness, their hair starts to stand on end a little bit. They get a shiver, and their eyes start to water. And you might feel like, well, I never had that experience. But I bring it up just because I think that would be those people would have especially strong intuitive sense of, actually, this world is not what I think it is. And even just hearing these teachings a little bit, even though I don't understand them fully, it's like I have some intuitive sense that, like, wow, this is not as it seems. And so I have some trust that even if you don't think, well, I don't feel like that, I think if we're here, I think there's some intuitive sense. Another similar encouraging verse from Aryadeva, who's actually Nagarjuna's direct disciple, says something like, when those who hear these teachings about emptiness or no independent self, and they have even like the slightest doubt that, like a doubt starts to arise in them that their experience as it's happening right now is not exactly in accord with reality. just that they're not even sure one way or the other, but they just start to doubt their everyday experience. That doubt, just the slightest doubt, starts to tear the very fibers of samsara apart, the very fibers of bondage and suffering and stuckness, just that, without little doubt. Isn't that great?
I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all it is a moment of questioning the construct, and the gig is up.
And then there's still, you know, of course, deepening, I think. And even if we can get a really clear conceptual understanding of how we do our thing of constructing the world, then it's an endless process. Of even if we can have a direct, non-conceptual understanding of that, still, this is according to the tradition too, still there's an endless process of, they call the path of familiarization, which is like, you know, there's the path of seeing, which is like directly seeing, like, oh, this is not what I think it is, and, you know, directly, non-conceptually. And then this path of familiarization, like, every moment of experience for maybe countless lifetimes, if you go for that story, maybe many, many, I mean, that's the classical story, is a long, long, long path of, like, reintegrating all our karmic tendencies and habits. Like, we fall back to sleep almost immediately. We're so accustomed to seeing that this is what I think it is. So, anyway, that's a long story about intuition, that I think there is something about intuition. And I also feel like the other side of this is, if people might wonder, well, can't we just go with intuition? Like, we have this sense things might not be the way they think they are. Let's just open to our intuitive sense. And that way, I think it's not totally trustworthy. I think without, like, dharma and really careful investigation of how things are, our intuition might be, you know, it's also overlaid with all these illusions and reifications and so on. So that's why this particular approach, just as you can tell, is very dear to my heart. This Madhyamaka Nagarjuna approach of using basically. I think the story is that actual logic is more trustworthy than intuition. So we do have that story too. Intuition gets us to come to the logic. But logic's not enough either, just logical, conceptual reasoning is definitely not enough. But without that, we may not see the subtlety, the layers of subtlety in which we're constructing our world. Like I mentioned this point about, we think there's no independent self, but there's just, I'm just five skandhas. That's not enough. We need a more subtle understanding, because if that were enough, it'd be very easy to just become completely free from all our illusions. And obviously, people seem to have to practice for a long time. Yes.
That reminds you, I listened to the last week's tape of the class, and there was something that you said a few times about what happens when I die is I merge with the universe, that idea.
Yeah, and the Buddha criticized that.
Yeah. Because I've always, in a nutshell, thought that that's what would happen.
Uh-huh.
But
I think a lot of people do. It's a nice story.
Yeah, intellectually or logically is the way I think about that. And I just wondered if this was not in accordance with Buddhism. I don't believe intellectually that there's an inherent self that merges with the universe. And I don't believe that the five skandhas actually exist, ultimately, that they're just a way of categorizing experience.
They're also a mental imputation.
And that came from studying the Heart Sutra, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking of the five languages as just the way of talking about our experience, mental and phenomenally, and defining this being as the dependently co-arisen self, which, if you got into the nuts and bolts, would be the five languages. Body and mind, and that doesn't have to merge with the universe because it already is. But that has an apparently separate thing. Since nothing is born and nothing dies, it's just that the appearance of that as a separate thing stops. But the stuff of which
it's made
consisted temporarily. Mm-hmm. Is now still with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say I'm just going to merge with the universe, that's what I mean.
Okay. So that is a little different than what the, I think what the Buddha was saying last week was what you first said is there's a true me, true self that's going to merge with the universal self.
I thought that's what intent was.
Yeah.
You said it three times, spaced out over it, and went, I gotta double check.
You were saying it was number two.
The soul merges with the universe as a soul, and it's still there, but it's not just the universe or something.
This cosmos, the position of this cosmos is the self, and I think they're using the word Atman here. After death, this I will be constant, permanent, eternal, not subject to change. I will stay just like that for an eternity.
Oh.
So that's from the sutra. Yeah. But what you said is still not exactly, maybe not the most accurate way of talking about it in terms of the tradition. Because the tradition would say, well, it's not that abstract. It's not that there's this particular continuum. Because if we have a view of rebirth,
That's a detail.
Well,
I mean, I was speaking.
It could be a detail. Yeah. I mean, again, we can have a whole class series on rebirth sometime because it's a juicy topic. Some people say it's just a detail. Some say you can't even practice Buddhism without the view of rebirth. This is Robert Thurman. You know, he's of that school. He's like, the whole thing doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
that's because it's a traditional take. And I think the reason it, just briefly, the reason it doesn't make sense to them is like, that this practice is not just like, you know, having the best life we can in this life. We're actually, our vow is to become like completely enlightened Buddha with like all the powers of a Buddha. And we're probably not going to do that in this life. That's just the traditional take. But we can, if we have this intention, like, I'm going to do as much as I can in this life, and that will, we evolve to the next life. That's where I'll start from.
We need all those lives.
We need all those lives, yeah. Yeah.
When we feel like I'm not going to make it in this life.
Yeah. And as Tenzin Roshi says, we still have to go through being a teenager in the next life. But we'll have maybe an easier time. Okay. Yes.
But that's something that can't be logically explained. It doesn't. It's
the rebirth thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely out of our realm. I'm sorry. This might be getting off topic.
I said this is a juicy topic. Rebirthing. And I mean, there are you know, proofs, you know, logical proofs for rebirth, but.
Logical.
They're logical, you know. They're, you know, using reasoning. But whether they hold up completely or not, like Stephen Batchelor, some of you might know him, you know, he's in that tradition, you know, he was very thoroughly went through the logical proof of rebirth, and at some point it started like irking him. He's like, there's something funny about this reasoning. It was like it assumed too much or something like that. Or it had something to do with the, you know, a split between body and mind. Now when I read, you can actually, if you're interested in this, Stephen Batchelor has his book called Confession of a Buddhist Atheist. It's like his autobiography actually. But this was a big turning point in his practice life. He was a monk in India. And upholding such a view, and at some point he felt like this actually, I feel like there's something off about, they're making this body-mind split in this view. Now when I read his story in the book, I think, I don't agree with what he is saying in terms of, I think he's making a leap. I mean, again, this is, we're getting way off track here, but it's not that there's a body-mind split in this proof. It's that body and mind are interdependent. The five skandhas are interdependent, which means they're not separate or the same. And therefore, you can have this complex thing happen with, as long as a consciousness is, a mind is dependent on some body, that can work. And we have that right now. And then for another life, we need the consciousness has to be dependent on some body too. Anyway, that would be interesting maybe at some point look at these proofs. And they're not as straightforward as Nagarjuna in this case. But in a way they are using dependent co-arising is the basic theory, the basic building theory for rebirth is dependent co-arising free from the extremes of eternalism and annihilationism. That's the basic story from the early Buddhist teaching onward. And then the actual details of the mechanics of how that dependent co-arising works in the story of rebirth gets more complicated. So we're going to look at this...
We better refute that self.
Yeah. So I just wanted to mention again some dictionary definitions. This is just Webster's dictionary. I think I maybe mentioned this before, but what we're looking at, what we're going to be looking at, is the independent or inherently existent self. So inherent means involved in the essential character or nature of something, or intrinsic is another synonym. And this also means something existing in and of itself, which means when we say independent existence, it means independent of concept. It's not dependent on, particularly, it's not dependent on conceptual imputation. It's not dependent on our ideas of it. It exists in and of itself, with no other, you know, mind creating it in the universe, something truly existing. That's what we're talking about, this kind of a self. And we might say that seems ridiculous, but again, when we're falsely accused, doesn't it feel as if the one who's has that response, that reaction, is like exists, isn't just a mental imputation, right? There's somebody here whose very identity is being threatened and wronged and threatened, yes. So also this word reify, I thought this was a really nice definition. We use the word reify some. It means to regard as a thing. Mm-hmm. Or to convert mentally into something concrete or objective. Mm. Isn't that great? It almost sounds like Nagarjuna could be saying it. Mm. To convert something, or to convert mentally into something, something concrete or objective, or to give definite form or content to, or to materialize. And this doesn't necessarily mean physical material. It could be like the self is not a physical thing, but it's to give like substance or essence or some, you know, it exists in and of itself. Okay. So, reasons that inherently existent self cannot exist. Of that page.
And this language, is this from Nagarjuna, or is this your?
This is my language taken from a lot of classical teachings, but trying to put in my own words. And you know, it's kind of like an exercise for me. Like this is something that, you know, I probably revised 20 times. Sure. So really trying to like look at what each word means, and trying to say it in different ways. So this is just a little introduction of what we're talking about at the top here. So an inherently, or these are synonyms now, in parentheses, intrinsically, essentially, independently existent I, or self, is defined as permanent, singular, and independent. So those are the classic qualities of it. Now, and it needs all three. Because it's important to see also that independent existence is not the same thing as permanence. So we're not, I think this is another kind of abbreviation that we sometimes do, is say, well, there's no permanent self or abiding self. Permanently abiding self is, again, that realization is not enough to undo samsara either. It's still very helpful, and impermanence is one of the Buddha's main teachings. But I remember we had this discussion in the last class series, I think, that impermanence is a quality of no abiding, no independent self. Or, like, conversely, permanence is a quality of an independent self. But, an independent self could even be impermanent. And so here's an example that may seem weird, but like we could actually see something changing. Like, I don't know, is this a good enough example of impermanence? There's like, this is like a changing thing. It's not, there's not, this finger is not like in a permanent location. or, you know, our bodies are obviously not impermanent, but even like, I don't know, watching something like anything, right? Like pouring a glass of water, watching sand fall out of your hand, anything that's like moving, or even something like a flower, time-lapse photography. How about this example? Time-lapse photos of a flower like wilting and just like decaying and like changing into just compost. It's like, wow. And then it's not even there anymore. So that's an impermanent thing. We can realize that everything is like that. But then we're watching that changing flower. Does it still not seem as if that flower exists independent of our conceptual imputation of it? Doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it seem like it's changing constantly, but it exists in and of itself. It's changing, but there's some essence of flower, and the essence of flower might even be like the flower is undergoing change, but the flowerness, the very nature of the flower seems to still be there. Now, at some point, it might disappear into compost, and then we maybe get confused what happened to it, but when we're just watching it decay, it still looks like a flower. Doesn't it seem like there's an impermanent object, but it exists independently. So that's why it's more subtle. You can watch it's not enough to just see that things are changing constantly. They still seem to exist from their own side.
You read the first paragraph of the first sentence.
Yeah, I just wanted to have somewhere here a little quote on this point that makes this also. Realization of impermanence means that one realizes that as soon as something comes into existence, it is in the process of deterioration. So that's like radical impermanence means as soon as it's coming into existence, it's also deteriorating. But impermanent things still appear to be truly existent, not just coming to be dependent on conceptual designation. Did you follow that? That's a subtle and important point.
Like a conceptually imputed flower, say? Because it's coming and going and we still think it's a flower?
Yeah, well, it has, I mean, it has, the impermanent flower has actually all, yeah. Or at least let's talk about, it has two and three.
Oh, okay.
It has it's conceptually imputed as a flower, and it's believed to be more than just a conceptual imputation. That's number three.
Number three doesn't depend on the idea of it being permanent, does it? More that it's independent, that it's just there, even if it's only there now, that it is really there.
Yeah.
The thing that we call something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Yeah.
To get rid of.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we hold most deeply and in the most cherished way. So very hard to locate this sense of how we feel like there's something really there. So when we talk about emptiness in general, that's what we mean, emptiness not of permanent things, but we mean emptiness of inherently existent things. And inherently existent and independently existent, I think, they're slightly different nuances, but they're basically interchangeable. And particularly, things are not independent of mental imputations. In other words, the way we see that they're empty is seeing how they depend on conceptuality. Is the main thing. The main liberating realization of emptiness is realizing that phenomena actually they dependently co-arise, we say, right? But the main type of dependent co-arising is that they depend on our concepts of them, which is again very close to this Yogacara mind only school, but this is actually in the Prasangika Madhyamaka school of Nagarjuna, this kind of like most subtle view of the middle way, is very similar to mind only in that they're saying they depend on us, also they things depend on the people who build them and all these other things, but that kind of interdependence isn't so liberating. That doesn't undermine our like our sense of reality, but to see how everything is dependent on our mind creating it, that's which is much harder to see, right?
And it's ourselves.
What's that?
Ourselves.
Especially ourselves.
Yeah. This mind creates.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's
yes, we're creating and this whole. And we're actually creating this view. We're using the mind's imputational capacities to kind of like, it almost feels like it's this spy, right? Going into our like, these teachings of Nagarjuna, for example, are like infiltrating. They're like, okay, we're going to use conceptual imputation here. This is what we use all day long. We're going to keep using the same stuff, but we're using these teachings that say the very thing that we're doing, and even the thing we're talking about right now, is all this conceptual imputation. So it's kind of like using the kind of poison to eradicate the poison.
I just had a flash of a class that Catherine taught years ago on the Diamond Sutra from Red Pine, and he used the term of that in the using, how should I say this? Oh, God. Homeopathically.
Oh, yeah.
And how that Buddha was using that it's the, you know, that you use the giving arising to a thought to challenge that. And so he called it homeopathic.
Yeah, it is like that, yeah.
And just when you said that, I just had this whole recollection of that.
And just as on a related topic while we're here, we might then wonder, but isn't it just going to be more and more layers of conceptuality? And like, how are we ever going to like get free of it, right? But so the classic image here that I think is very beautiful, it's like sticks to make a fire, right? That you're, you know, you know how to do this, right? You're using these sticks are like conceptual ideas. We're like buried in sticks all the time. So we're going to like make, we're going to like pick up two really good sticks of, you know, Madhyamaka teaching or something. We start rubbing them and to make this fire, and then the fire is going to actually like burn up all the sticks around it of all these other false views and everything, and then it's going to burn up the very sticks that made the fire. So in the end, we have to throw in the sticks that we're using. Or that's also the image of like abandoning the raft when you get to the other shore. But if we don't make that fire, there's like a lot of sticks to burn, right? So first and in a way, we maybe take care of the, you know, as we're refuting everything else, like the very last thing to go will be these views, like the emptiness of emptiness. Right? You could say it would be like the culmination. But if we don't want to leap right, if we just, oh yeah, everything's empty, including emptiness, so let's not even start. It won't work. Okay. We have to make this fire.
Where you have two things that you believe are true, and then you just put them next to each other and you try to find it out. You hope that truth wins over. Throws it to the mat. Take that truth and apply it to everything else.
Maybe in this case, I don't even know if we have to hope. You know, if we do this really skillfully, it's like it'll just work out that way. Truth itself will take care of it. It's like we don't. That's the beauty of these things too. Is like it might seem like we have to like try on this, especially things like rebirth. That's why I wouldn't say we should. Come on, just like believe it. The Buddha himself says, don't believe anything I say. Check this out for yourself, and particularly these teachings of Nagarjuna. Are like he's very careful in his constructing his whole masterwork. That he never says like, and you know, just believe me on this one, okay, folks. He's never going to say that. He's going to say you have to just like follow this logic. And I'm not even proving any particular view. I'm just like undoing any other view, you know, false views. That's particularly this Prasangika Madhyamaka, this kind of branch of Madhyamaka is really into like not setting up anything in its place. It's just refuting everything else. And people, there's even treatises within the treatise of Nagarjuna. He has the kind of a person arguing with him saying, but isn't everything you're saying also, you know, just mere construction and also empty? And Nagarjuna would say, yeah. It is, exactly. You have some problems? Okay, so if such an I, this is second sentence, if such an I inherently exists in the way it is conceived, it's kind of this premise that we do conceive it as inherently existing, it must be, this is where we're going to get into this thing now, it must be inherently identical to or inherently unrelated, different and separate from the aggregates of body and mind. And that just lists the five skandhas there. So this is where we started the talk about if something inherently exists, if we're comparing two things, and we're talking about things truly existing independently, they have to be the same or different. You can't have any mixing going on. Remember we had this discussion, and it was clarified when you said, "But what about, you know, you and the sculpture?" And then we say, "Well, we're actually if we're talking about interdependent things or dependently arising things, they are actually not just one or the other. They're interdependent. But if something were to exist independently, it means it doesn't depend on the other thing. Then the only relationship can be identity or difference." Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a simple point, but it's the basis for what's going to be done here. You follow that?
If it inherently existed, then it would be either completely identical or completely different.
Yeah, so now we're going to apply that to the self. We're talking about an independently existing self. If this were to be totally independent in and of itself, it wouldn't depend on mm-hmm. the body and mind, right? This is kind of reversing it. They usually don't talk this way, but it would depend on, but it can't. So it must be, if it were to exist, it would have to be exactly identical to the body and mind or completely like separate from it. Those are the only two possibilities for an independently existing self.
And neither one can be true, so.
But before we go into seeing why they can't be true, to get this point, they sometimes call this, what we're talking about now, is called the entailment, they sometimes say, because certain realizations will entail from this. It's not yet the reasoning. It's not yet the analysis. It's just setting up the premise. But it's really, if this doesn't make sense, the rest won't either. So, any questions about this part? If there were to be an independently existent self, which is the one we're going to investigate, it's independent means it doesn't depend on other things, like, for example, the body and mind. So, its relationship to the body and mind must be either completely identical, because if it's completely identical, it doesn't have to depend on it. It's exactly the same thing. That's not dependent. That's like, it is just the body and mind. Right? That might seem weird, but that would be one possibility, right? And then, or it would have to be like an independent self that's like, you know, not actually dependent on the body and mind, completely separate and independent from the body and mind. And a lot of Nagarjuna uses this kind of reasoning. So this is, and it's a strange way of thinking, but it's not that complicated or anything. It's just that if something's independent and you're comparing it to something else, its relationship must be exactly identical or completely separate.
Because otherwise there's dependency.
Otherwise there's dependency.
Of some degree.
If they're related, you could even say related is the same as dependent. Mm-hmm. If they're related in any way, other than sameness or difference, then they're dependent.
Or if it contained the other?
Well, we're going to go into that part.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think let's not jump to it yet, but that will be dealt with.
Oh, right.
It's one of these five.
And vice versa.
So, can people follow that?
I'm struggling. It's like some part of me just goes, oh, yeah. And then I don't see how we can be separate. How something can be separate.
Well, maybe because you actually understand that, like, it's impossible.
Is that what you were just saying?
We're saying if something were to be independently existing, and it's not, there is no such thing, right? But we're almost like pretending as if there could be in order to really carefully, completely prove to our conceptual mind that this an independent thing cannot exist using logic. So you already say, well, how could there be such a thing? Maybe that's what you're doing. And it's easy to do that because we've already heard about everything's dependently co-arising. But it's saying if there were to be an independently existing thing in relation to something else, it would have to be either exactly identical, that would be okay. They would both be completely independent. Or completely separate, like there's two things. Let's say, if they were both actually existed in and of themselves, which ironically, even though we know it's maybe not true, we do see them. Like this isn't just a conceptual imputation. There's a recorder and a watch. They seem to exist in and of themselves. But if they were really that way, independently existing, they would have to be either completely separate. They don't depend on each other. Which would look like the case here because they're not the same, but maybe there's some things that could be like exactly identical, like just an example I thought of. Well, they're still going to be separate, right? Because they're separate things. But let's say I mentioned a collection of trees and a forest. Okay, so it's like if the forest really truly existed in and of itself, it would have to be like identical to or separate from the trees. And in that case, we might say, oh, it actually looks identical to the tree. The forest and the trees are just two different names for the same thing. There's no separation. They're exactly the same. They are this. So that would be an example. We might be able to see that. Or if this collection of trees truly existed, it would have to be the same. It wouldn't depend on a forest, or the forest wouldn't depend on the trees. They would be exactly the same if they truly existed. You can think about this at home, too.
But basically, it's trying to get our minds around something that it's impossible.
It's impossible.
You know, and it's just setting it up as a logical thing.
Yeah.
If we try to, you know, mm-hmm. get our heads against the wall to understand it, it's going to be futile.
Yeah, it's going to be futile. But it's saying that it's the proof. Yeah, it's the proof. And I think it's worth saying, just, you know, to really go through this, because it has an effect on the mind to go through these steps. And often they say in these commentaries, don't leap ahead to what you think the answers will be. With all of Nagarjuna, they say, you know, don't just say, I know it's all going to be empty in the end. Like, actually go through, like, follow what Nagarjuna is doing, or in this case, what we're doing in this page. And it has an effect, it trains the mind to, like, start, like, opening to different ways of seeing things. And you can see what he's doing. And then maybe once you get used to what he's doing, then you maybe don't have to go through all the steps. But that's the entailment. The basic proposition is that if the self were to inherently exist in and of itself, it would have to be either identical to the five skandhas or completely separate. And even here it says, to emphasize it more, inherently identical. Are inherently unrelated, meaning completely. Sometimes I have this view of, like, in the realm of if there were such thing as inherent existence, everything is like frozen ice. It's like unworkable. So it's like this and the, it's all like black and white in this realm. Mm-hmm. It's either or. There's no like, there's no relationality. So the difference between things is also not like an interdependent difference, but like inherently different, like totally separate, like no relation, no relationality.
Like politics.
Like politics scene.
Like never the twain shall meet. We're past the era of compromise.
Separate from or identical. In other words, if the I is related, so this is just going to say it in a different way now. In other words, if the I is related to or dependent on body and mind in some other way than complete identity or complete difference, it cannot inherently exist. So that's just the same, just another twist on the same sentence. But it's nice to like try all these different sentences. Like I was just reading this, some commentary today, and like all people put it in these slightly different ways, and it's like it hits me so strongly when somebody like, and you can tell that they get the point when they can like start to put it into their own way of putting it in a new kind of creative way, even though it's making the same point. So if you have on that reading list, if you're into this stuff, you can, you know, different people will talk about it slightly differently, different words, but they're always making the same points. So this is two ways of talking, right? If the I exists in the way it's conceived, it must be identical to or different than body and mind. In other words, if the I were related, this is the opposite now, if it's dependent on or related to the body and mind in some way other than complete identity or complete difference, then it can't inherently exist because it depends. There's some dependent relationship. These two possibilities of sameness or difference can be elaborated into five relationships, all of which are still aspects of sameness or difference. So I think we shouldn't explain that until we go through these five and you'll see what that means. But they're still really, these five are basically just branches of these same two possibilities of sameness or difference. If the I is not in one of these five relationships to body and mind, it cannot, does not inherently exist. One must come to understand through reasoning that something that is inherently neither the same entity, no, something that is inherently neither the same entity as nor a different entity from body and mind does not inherently exist. That's before going through these steps, but just coming to that conclusion first.
No, I'm just
stretching. Upon such a conclusion, this is before, again, it's kind of neat, just this getting this entailment thing, that something must exist one way or another. If one can come to that conclusion, even before reasoning, going through these reasonings, one begins to doubt the inherent existence of the I, like starting to doubt an old friend. Means like, you still don't, you haven't actually undone it yet, because that's what these steps are going to do. But you start to, and I think this is maybe what's already happening, maybe for you, and as we start to see that, but wait a second, how could there be? And just by the very setup, you're starting to see like, wait a second now. How can anything exist independently? But you still might feel, again, experientially, when you look at, you can do it with a self or look at a thing, doesn't it seem to exist independently? Particularly, we're talking about independent of mental construction. Isn't there still a watch back here? You know? Like, I really think that there is, and I know what it looks like.
I do too.
I think
there
really is.
Yeah, I mean,
find it, but I think it's somewhere.
But it's just like starting to doubt an old friend. I just like that was some, one of the commentaries said this. I thought it was a great metaphor because this old, old friend that we've had since we were born of this independently existing self, this cherished identity of me, is like my oldest, dearest friend. And like when we're starting to look at this, wait a second. I thought you were totally trustworthy and reliable here. Wait a second. And this is like a good doubt. having to come to such a logical conviction, this is a preliminary conviction in this case, one can then start to prove step by step through the reasonings below that the I cannot exist in one of these five ways. And this, so we'll save this for next time. And this is, if you look at Nagarjuna's first verse, this is what, it's a little like summary of these proofs on this page. Nagarjuna.
From chapter 18.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The verse is, if the self, and we're talking about the independent self, were identical with the aggregates of body and mind, it would have to arise and cease. That's a little reasoning. If it were completely different from the aggregates, it would not have the characteristics of the aggregates. That's the kind of summary. And then these five like go into great detail of like explaining that verse. But this is like really the key verse. And it's all based on identity and difference. And if you read the rest of Nagarjuna's verses on the middle way, a lot of his reasonings use this this concept of identity and difference as a you know, once you see what it means, it's a kind of a simple proof. And he uses other ones too, but identity and difference is kind of a neat one. It's very concise and clean. It's very clean, cleanly cutting through like Manjushri's sword. Any final
Before this series is over, are we going to have an idea of who it is that's doing the Bodhisattva vows?
Who's doing the Bodhisattva vows?
Yeah.
I mean, who says I vow to save them?
Yeah, who are the sentient beings being saved?
It'll all be clear.
Hopefully.
Some people.
I was just chanting themselves through these contingent.
Some people like to say, well, we shouldn't say I vow, let's just say like vowing to save them and stuff. But the I is kind of nice, I think, if you take it as the number two, just the conceptually imputed I, because that's the one that does actions. This is another point about the conceptually imputed self. In conventionally speaking, that's the one that produces karma, does actions. It's the one that receives the conventionally speaking, receives the fruits of the actions, the effects of the actions, and it's what, practices the way, and it's what vows to save all beings. So when we say, I vow to save them, we just say, there's not a true independent self that vows to save them, but there is this conventionally appearing mere I that's like our great friend. That's a pretty trustworthy friend, actually. The other one's like the one we can start to doubt. Number three. Number three, old friend, we start to doubt. But this number two is a good, good friend we should keep forever and ever. And, yeah, for life. And just, and let it be totally devoted to saving all beings and practicing Buddha's way. May all beings employ their mere I in wholehearted practice indefinitely. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I bow to the coming.